Good morning, everyone. We'll be starting in a few minutes, so there are seats in the front. Feel free to take the front seat. Okay.
We're almost just presenting to each other.
Ready to go? Okay, let's get ourselves started. Good morning, everyone. My name is Steve Shang. I'm a senior manager for policy and technical advisory support at ICANN. And today's session is about defining the requirements for internationalized registration data. Since we don't have a lot of people here, I thought maybe begin we do some quick introductions so that this will help us to engage in the discussion afterwards. So you want to quickly state your name and your affiliation?
I'm Dmitry Bilevsky. I'm from a Russian backend registry provider. I just want to listen the current ideas and maybe add something about Russian implementation. Thank you.
I'm Charles Johnson, also just seeking information.
Marc Blanchet, Virginie, part of a member of the study team.
Steve Shang, I can staff.
So, Jim Galvin from Phileas and one of the presenters.
Chris Dillon from University College London and one of the co-chairs of the Translation and Transliteration of Contact Information PDP Working Group.
Susie Johnson, staff, ICANN staff.
Margie Milam, ICANN staff.
Owen Smigelski, ICANN staff, with compliance. Saw have an impact on us, and I was actually on the original IRD working group with Jim and Steve before I joined ICANN.
Thank you.
Rudy Vansnick, NPOC and co-chair of the PDP working group, together with Chris Dillon.
Thank you, and let's get started. So I'll provide some background first, and I'll invite the guests on my left to give a few presentations, and then we engage in a discussion. So very quickly, some high-level background information. Today, much of the currently accessible registration data is encoded freeform in US ASCII. This is a convenient convenient, you know, history where, you know, it has always been this way. But as we're seeing more internationalized domain names, there is a push from the community to have internationalized registration data. So the WHOIS policy review team recognized this issue and in their final report highlights the need to define requirements, data models, and evaluate solutions for internationalized registration data. So following the report, here are the three efforts from the ICANN community initiatives. The first one is, as part of the implementation of the WHOIS review team report, there's an expert working group to determine formed, and its charter is to determine the requirements for internationalized registration data. There's a second effort is to study and evaluate available solutions for the submission and display of the data. And finally, a GNSO policy development process on the translation and transliteration of contact information. So before I invite each of the guests to present an update, I figure it's good to highlight the relationship of these activities. So if you look at the registration data today, these are roughly fall into the following categories. So the first four categories are mainly social data provided by registrant, technical contact, administrative contacts. The other data are a set of, you know, technical and other information very useful as part of the registration service lifecycle. So if you look at them together, there's a need to figure out whether to internationalize, what are the available standards for internationalize, and also the structure and annotation. And this is what the expert working group is tackling upon. Now, with respect to the social data, there's a very specific set of questions. Should the contact data be translated or transliterated? Who bears the burden for such transformations? And this is indeed a policy issue being tackled by the GNSO PDP. And then lastly, we have a research study that documents today's current practices for submission and display, and also look at, you know, accuracy issues and available tools for translation and transliteration that will help. Margie?
If you don't mind, can you explain the difference between translation and transliteration in case the audience doesn't know the difference?
So, for example, I'm my native language is in Chinese, so I use a Chinese example. Let's say in China, CNNIC is called 中国互联网信息中心. All right, so that's the Chinese name. A translation for that would be the China Internet Network Information Center. So that's the kind of, you translate that into, let's say, English. The transliteration here, in a way, is more of a transcription where you put the phonetic sound into a Latin script. So you say, 中国互联网中心. And you present that in the Latin script. So that's called transliteration, or in some cases, transcription. So that's it. We have a few more. We have seats in the front, and we're going to engage the discussion. You're welcome to join up in the front. So these are the relationship between these activities. Before going to further, I want to also highlight of one important distinction that's in relation about localization versus internationalization. We've been talking about this a lot. I actually borrow some slides from Jim. So in terms of the localization we're talking here is the adaptation of the registration data to meet the language, cultural, region, and other requirements of a target data consumer group. So let me give you one example of a localization. This example is adapted from, you know, the current JPRS, who is output, but we localize it further. So on here, you could see there are three things that are being localized. First, the data itself, there are some localized data. For example, the organization name, the address, the name of the contact, those are in the local script. And we also have the label itself, the label on the left-hand side that identifies what the content is. Those are also localized to the local audience. And finally, other information regarding, for example, dates, telephone numbers, those are localized to fit the need of the local community. So internationalization, on the other hand, is different. It's the adaptation of registration data to enable easy localization. So it's the localization may be done, you know, at the client or other levels, but internationalization provide enablement for localization. So in the context here, we're talking about ensure data elements represented and transmitted in standard forms, ensure that data is appropriately encapsulated or tagged to allow localization. So with that distinction, here's the agenda for today. We will have someone. Oh, it's Samart here? No, Samart is not here. So perhaps what we do is we move on to the first presentation by the WHOIS review team, Internationalized Registration Data Working Group, on my left-hand side, Jim, to present. And followed by that, Chris and Rudy from the GNSO PDP to give us an update. And then we'll have Samart to give an update. After that, we'll have an open discussion. So with that, let me hand it over to you, Jim. So let me see here. Oh.
Thank you, Steve. Next slide. So this is just some historical, you know, context for the working group. In the interest of time, I'll just sort of move on from here to the next slide. People can look at where the group came from. Our charter has us producing two work products. One is to make some recommendations about requirements for internationalized registration data. So whatever we think might be helpful in general to the entire registration system and, you know, how we can better move contact information in a direction which meets the needs of internationalization. I mean, as Steve said before in his introduction and setup, the situation today, for largely legacy reasons, of course, is that registration data is primarily in U.S. ASCII and in English. And that's because of being born out of the WHOIS protocol and probably also partly the origins of the internet having been focused in the U.S. originally. A second work product that we will produce is a data model to match those requirements, which we're hopeful ideally would serve to make it convenient to store the data and have all of the right principles in place to make it much more straightforward for interoperable implementations between registrars, registries, and the services that go with them. Next slide, please. So this is the approach that the working group took. We spent some amount of time, you know, thinking about how it was we were going about doing this. Obviously, we're going to take into account the many other activities, both inside and outside of ICANN, that are, you know, related to registration data. And there have been a number over the years, and there are several in active now, and we're going to hear about two of them here today. One I want to focus on here on this slide is the grouping data by categories. One of the interesting questions that we had right up front in this particular working group was, what data elements are we working with? Because if you look around and you look in some of these other groups that have been doing this, there have been a number of surveys, if you will, of what ccTLDs have done with respect to registration data, what elements they include, and, of course, registries. Now, for gTLDs, most of that, for gTLDs, it is a known quantity because it's indicated by contractual requirements for both registrars and registries what data you have to collect, although, interestingly, they're not all exactly the same. So, you know, that presents one set of issues. And then, of course, ccTLDs present another whole set of data elements. What our group decided to do as we kind of stepped back and looked at this is we realized that we could think about the data in terms of categories. Rather than focusing on specific data elements do tend to group. And that was one of the things that simplified our work a great deal. This way, we don't have to concern ourselves with specific elements, and some of the other groups, in particular the Directory Services Expert Working Group, will probably have something to say about elements to be collected. And this would allow us to continue in parallel along with these other groups. IETF Weirds has created its own profile of data elements that's useful for output. And again, you know, this way, if we just stuck with categories, we were hopeful, and so far it seems to be working, that we would easily be able to cover everything that was coming out and was visible today. You know, perhaps in the future it would be easier to just create a new category if we needed it in order to create some requirements. And the next slide, please. As Steve said, he started talking about localization, internationalization, and we had developed these slides in this working group, this concept. So I'll add the following context to think about the difference between localization and internationalization. The way we are thinking about this is translation. These are endpoints. Localization and internationalization represent one end, each end of the translation and transliteration requirement that's also being examined by the next working group that we're going to hear about over here. So our responsibility is in this working group is to create the internationalization requirements, the opportunity to have the data in a form that lets you always get to the local form. Our model here was that the data would come to us in a local form because a registrant would bring it to you and provide it to you in whatever form was appropriate for them. It would have to get into an internationalized form in order to be in the system. And then on the directory services, on the other end, when you want to do a query and do a lookup, you again need to localize it in order to be useful to the user who did the lookup to find out who was the registrant and things like that. Next slide, please. So this is a particular example. This example actually represents a mix. I mean, you could imagine in an extreme case, if you will, the ends of the spectrum are that the local form is always U.S. ASCII in English, or the local form is always whatever language is decided would be at that directory services side. This represents a bit of a mix because you do see some U.S. ASCII English labels, and in fact, some information has that the U.S. ASCII script. And then there are some other labels that are purely in Japanese, with of course some Japanese script and the language for the content of it. So there's, you know, opportunities for doing things sort of in the middle if that seems like the right thing to do. And that lends itself, next slide, please, if you come from the internationalization context, again, you want to be able to get the data in a form that allows you to operate with it and solve different problems in different situations. And that was our approach for looking at this problem and coming up with our set of recommendations. Next slide. The next thing that we did was realize that there are probably some principles. We needed a mechanism in which to make decisions about what would be the right thing to do in choosing some of the requirements that we wanted to recommend. And so we have two particular principles guiding all of our work. The first one we're calling the user capability principle. And basically, this simply says that a user, the registrant in particular, should not be obligated to do anything other than what they would ordinarily do. So in the particular thing to recognize is that a user would only be able to use whatever language or script they are most skilled at. People are born in a region, you know, you grow up and you learn to talk and read and write and those things. You should not burden a user with having to create something in a particular language or script. They should be able to do whatever it is they do according to what's natural to them, so whatever the natural form is. The second principle that we had here was obviously to try to keep things as simple as possible. It's, you know, in some ways, compared to the system we have today, complicated enough to get to internationalization. So if there were choices that we could make in some of the requirements, we would always choose to move in the direction of reusing something that was already done rather than trying to invent something new. And if there were ever competitive choices, we would try to make some judgment about which was the simplest choice and go with that instead. Okay, next slide. So there are three sets of requirements here that I want to talk about. And next slide, please. So the first one here in the high-level requirements gets to the user capability principle quite directly. And I've actually already given this. You know, the registrant should only have to use whatever language or script they're skilled at. Whatever their natural place is, that's what they should be obligated to use. And you could not, it would be unreasonable to obligate them to do the translation and transliteration, which that particular statement would be input to the next working group that we're going to hear about here, since they're going to be making the decision about where the translation and transliteration will occur and who would have to do it. An interesting observation that we make in this high-level requirement is from a business point of view. What this suggests is that not all registrars will be able to serve all registrants. I mean, that's sort of a natural inference, a natural implication, as opposed to a consequence, I guess, depending on your point of view, of having that kind of requirement. A registrar, in the internet terms, you don't really have any boundaries. So you don't have any national boundaries. You don't have language or script boundaries. So a registrar puts up a website, they're naturally visible to the entire world. So an implication here is that that might be true from a deployment context, but it's possible that a registrant could get to a registrar and not be able to work with that registrar because the registrar is not providing functionality in the language or script that the registrant can deal with. And so in that case, they would simply, you know, you would have to reject or just not be able to work with that particular registrant. And the second part of that, of course, is that if a registrar wants to target a particular community or region and or a registry wants to target those things, they have mechanisms, the registry has mechanisms to motivate or incentivize registrars to support targeted regions and making that more visible. Okay, next slide, please. The other important high-level requirement here is that all data elements in the system should always be tagged with whatever the language or script is that is characteristic of that data element. And that's important in an internationalization context. If you don't have the data stored that way, then you don't know what you can do with it. You don't know how to take it to the next step. If you want to localize it, you have to know what its original characteristics are. And so those are the requirements that apply throughout the system and for everything. Next slide. So now what we have is a whole set of slides here which have the data categories on the left and particular requirements on the right. And I really only want to highlight one of them. For the most part, these should seem fairly reasonable. And I base that on the fact that in our working group, we came to consensus fairly quickly on the requirements for most of the categories. The only one which, even in our working group, is sort of open to some discussion at the moment is the what to do about the address of a registrant or the address information that goes with any contact information, the registrant, technical, and administrative. And we actually have three proposals that are in discussion in the working group. So here I'm going to highlight these and say quickly what they are. And this should be considered kind of a heads up, if you will, because we're going to have an interim report that we will publish soon. And you will have the opportunity to publicly comment on that report. And one of the reasons for the interim report is to call out this particular question and get input from the community about what people think would be most appropriate. So the ends of the spectrum are, for the address of the registrant, you can have one end of the spectrum, which is free-form text, meaning you're going to let the registrant just enter whatever it is they want to enter. They'll put in their address information in whatever seems to make sense for them at the time. The downside of this, of course, is it really makes it very difficult for a registrar to do the data validation requirements and to meet those requirements that are going to come to them in the 2013 RAA. I mean, there's limited structure then to the data if it's all freeform text, and so that puts a heavier burden on a registrant in that context. The other end of the spectrum is freeform text still, but you have a single script. So, for example, U.S. ASCII, and you maintain the model of U.S. ASCII in English. That's one possibility. Or a single script, meaning whatever's appropriate for the TLD. So the TLD itself and the registry may, in fact, declare that there's a certain language or script that the TLD is supporting. And so you're going to want all the registration data in that form. So again, a single form because of that particular requirement. Obviously, there's the spot in the middle there is still free-form text, but you say that the address should be appropriate for the region in which it is located. And what that really is referencing back to is the UPU requirements for postal addresses in general. The UPU actually allows postal addresses and the format and requirements for those to be specified by the national or sovereign state that is a member of the UPU. So the only global requirement on postal forms is that the country code has to be in English, or the name of the country needs to be in English. That allows it to get to that particular region of the world. And then the address, other than that, could be in the form that particular country is willing to accept and written in that particular language and script, whatever works there. So this would obligate, again, registrars would need to know if you're in a country, now you sort of need to know what to expect from contact information from that registrant, wherever they're located. You'd need to find out the region, and then you would have to create all of your system based on that and be able to check the address. This probably facilitates data validation, you know, because now you're going to be able to know the requirements in that area and work with whatever's there. But, you know, it's an open question. There's those three things. So next slide, and the next slide after that. In fact, get all the way down to the next steps here if you want. You can see the slides online and read through those and look at them. Happy to answer any questions. Again, our next step here initially is to get a draft interim report out, which we hope to do very quickly after the Singapore meeting here. And then we'll begin work on the data model while we wait for the public comment period on this interim report to work through so that we can take that on board and finish up our final work products. We hope to get the requirements work product done in time for the London meeting, assuming we can publish it soon and have a sufficient comment period. So thank you.
Thank you, Jim, for that update. Do we have any maybe we can take one or two questions very quickly before we move on to the next presentation. Any other quick response? Go ahead, Rudy.
Yeah, Rudy Van Stick for the transcript. A very interesting presentation, Jim, that allows us to have a clear view on what direction your working group is going to take. However, I have a few questions with relation to the fields you're defining. First of all, do you think about having multiple fields for specific data categories? I'm clarifying. For an address, for instance, are you going to foresee a address record field for the natural language and a second field for the same address in US ASCII, for instance. Based on the definition of your data model, are there fields that you consider that would never be translated or transliterated? For example, the name service, for instance, would probably never be translated.
So thank you, Rudy, for those questions. Taking the second one first, yes, there are data elements that we would expect to never be translated or transliterated. That would be because the requirement is they're based on a particular data space. I'm trying to find the right word. I'm forgetting the word. Let me just give you an example. So the registrar ID, for example, okay, there's a well-defined string for the registrar ID, and that exists in a registry that ICANN keeps. So that's just going to be what it is, and there really wouldn't be any reason to translate or transliterate that. I mean, you look it up as is. You can imagine dates and formats, dates, fields, would not need to be. And as you said, the domain name, too. The domain name has its own set of requirements. You know, the IETF specifies what those names are supposed to look like. One of the things that we are doing with the domain name, though, is that you will actually have both of the U label and the A label form that you want to have in the system. The reason for that is you need the A label form to ensure that you have precisely what it is that you want. It's getting the A-label form ensures that you have canonicalized the name and the characters that are in an IDN name in particular. And then having the U-label form just makes it convenient to be able to have the original and always have that around too. Going to your first question about having multiple data elements. So, yes, if, for example, we're waiting for your group to actually make a decision on translation and transliteration before we can answer that question. So we do see in front of us the fact that there are multiple ways in which this stuff might come out. It depends a great deal on the decision that your group makes. If you're going to decide that there should be a single language and script in which all data appears, then it would seem to make sense. This is our current thinking in the working group, that there would always have to be two data elements, two copies. One would be whatever the natural language form in that came, and then the second would be the translation or transliteration of that into whatever the default is that your group decides needs to exist. but if there is no burden like that, then there would only need to be one and be no reason to have another one. So an open question that comes up if you do that, and I would hope that your group would address this particular question too, once you create two forms of the data, you now bring a number of questions, additional questions that have to be answered. Which one's the primary? How do you keep them in sync? Who's responsible for keeping them in sync? And what are the data validation requirements, given that you now have two copies, of making sure that they can map back and forth? So thank you.
Thank you. Margie?
Thank you for that presentation. It's very interesting. I had a question about the composition of the working group. Are there a fair number of registrars involved in the group? Because some of the implications of what you're suggesting could radically change their business models. I mean, you know, I understand the logic behind the recommendations, but, you know, if there's a registrar that's selling globally right now, they have to, if these recommendations go are adopted, they would have to change their model so that they can accept the local character, you know, the local data elements, or somehow and make it known before you register that they can only support certain languages or scripts. So just curious whether, you know, you have that kind of engagement in the in your working group.
Yes, so thank you for that. As with any expert working group, it tends to be limited in terms of the number of people that are on it. And in this particular group, they chose 9 people, but they did choose a couple of people who have registrar experience. And I'm only remembering at the moment GoDaddy. I guess GoDaddy is always the easiest one to remember. We do have some people there. But in fairness, none of the people in the working group are obligated to speak, you know, on behalf of the particular communities in which they operate. So they're offering, you know, an opinion based on their advice and their experience, which is appropriate. That's why this is just a working group as compared to the PDP group, which we have over here, which is the next one. We make recommendations, which will then be, you know, subject to community review and analysis. It also turns out it's because of exactly the question that you asked, and our position with the addresses is it is the registrars in the group that realize that this is a, you know, could be potentially a pretty significant issue. And we wanted to give the opportunity for some broad community input, and that was one of the primary reasons for an interim report. And we figured, well, let's see what kind of comments we can get from people, and, you know, we'll deal with those when they come in. Thanks.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Margie. In the interest of time, let's move on to a next presentation, an update from the PDP working group. Chris and Rudy, let me pull up the slide for you.
Thank you very much, Chris Dillon, for the transcript. Okay, next slide, please. This is just the background. So we started work drafting the charter in September, from January we've actually been, and from December we've been meeting weekly, just to do the work. Next slide, please. The two main questions that we're looking at are these two we can see. In the first one, the word desirable is very important. A lot hangs on that word. Whether it is desirable to translate contact information to a single common language or transliterate contact information to a single common script. The language may be English. The common script may be ASCII. Then the second question, who should decide, who should bear the financial burden of doing this? At the bottom of that, we've got a link to the charter, and probably the most important thing here is just further information, which is the wiki page. We've used the wiki a lot. It's, as far as I know, completely up to date, so you can just go in there and see what we're doing and where we've made progress, where we haven't made progress. Okay, and then these are just those were just the sort of surrounding areas which we've been talking about, sort of commercial feasibility and just generally other work going on in this area. Okay, and here we just drill down a bit. So we're looking at what are the benefits, and this is really expanding on this concept of desirability. So effectively, that breaks down into what are the purposes of the of contact information. Identified 11 purposes have been identified, so that will be one part of the matrix. And then we've got various stakeholder groups and less progress there, exactly who those stakeholder groups are. So that's something that's being worked on. Okay. And then there are again sort of smaller issues like how is this likely to affect? Well, it can't affect, but but what's the relationship between this and the 2013 registration accreditation agreement? How could it affect future RAAs? Then we've got the question, okay, when, if there is going to be a change, when should it come in? Okay, and this we've already spoken about, so next slide. Okay, and so what we've been doing recently is asking for input. We've sent out questionnaires to SOs and ACs, and we've had some amount of input from various groups. The Thai people who came in a moment ago have produced, you know, are an example of that input. The input is of a very high quality, but we want more. The official deadline is actually the end of this month, but to be honest, that's just another way of saying as soon as possible. If people sort of get back to us, we're not going to turn it down. And next slide. Okay, thank you very much. Any questions?
Actually, Rudy, would you like to add anything to that?
Well, I would like to compliment Chris with the work he is doing in the wiki. It's amazing. He is a specialist in languages, so I let him do, and I'm trying to do the technical part of the discussions rather than going into the language issues. It's interesting to work together as a co-chair, and I think it's one of the samples where some working groups are needed to have two co-chairs, one looking in one direction, the other looking in another direction, and combine it at the end. But based on what Jim said, it means that we will have to hurry up a little bit because they are awaiting our decision with regards, for instance, the single or multiple fields definition. So it looks like the as soon as possible will be yesterday instead of tomorrow.
Yes, all I can do is agree with that. I certainly agree with Rudy's former point that this is it's quite a wide area. Having two co-chairs is a real advantage.
Thanks, Chris and Rudy. Any questions? I can take a few quick questions. Okay.
It's too clear. All right. Do we have to turn? Do we have to translate before you can give some questions?
Okay. Thank you very much indeed.
So next one, we have another study to evaluate available solutions for the submission and display of internationalized registration data. And Mark Blanchett, who is a member of the study team, will provide us with a quick update. Mark?
Marc Blanchet. So, using our own, doing our own dog food, I'll present in French so you can translate. Bonjour et bienvenue. Okay, so we're a team of people that are doing this study. Sarmad Hussein, as you may know, being our linguistic expert. Myself and my colleagues are doing more the technical work on this study. So the key areas of the study is document the submission and display practices of internationalized registration data, access, availability and cost of open source and commercial solutions for transliterating and translating contact data, and evaluate the accuracy implications for transliteration and translation of contact data. And for all those three areas at the end of the presentation, there's a summary of where we are at the moment with those three topics. So the way we are doing our study is first we survey existing practices for collecting data in local languages and scripts. Study translation and transliteration requirements and methods for languages and scripts, and identify tools for transliteration and translation and evaluate their availability, cost, and accuracy. Something I would like to say is all those three are, you know, obviously not comprehensive. We're not testing every possible tool. We're not surveying all the possible existing practices. So we're trying to do the best coverage we can, but it's obviously not, you know, fully comprehensive. The next three slides are terminology, and I'm not sure I want to go through all these in detail. It's more for your reference. I'll skip for the next slide.
the next one. So there's multiple ways to transform a string to another string. And so, you know, translation, transliteration, and all that stuff. So we sometimes, so terminology is important, and at the same time, sometimes we talk about transformation in the sense of, you know, one, you know, a generic term to include all the possible ways. To talk about transliteration, there is an example in at the end of the definition. I won't, not being an Arab Arabic person, I won't try to, you know, say it. But so that's one thing we're currently evaluating in terms of tools. And related to transliteration is the other point below, which is reversibility. For example, you don't want to have data loss while you transform from one piece to another and then back, because then you're having some problem. Click. So there's different ways to transform. An accurate transformation is something that has the highest constraints, because you may use it in you know, in court, or, you know, something matching with some legal documents such as passport or stuff. So this is and back to the other groups working on this problem space, obviously depending on the level you need, would have different requirements and therefore different impacts and on the tools you need and things you will do. So this is pretty important to get in into context. And so accurate in transformation, as you could think, is actually going to be more difficult than the other lower levels, if you want. So consistent is transformation is a lower level, which, you know, enables you to match, but is not necessarily fully accurate. An example is an address. You can, you know, on Google Map or any mapping software, you could, you know, give some information about the address, and then you get the actual matching. However, it may not be fully accurate. And ad hoc is, you know, the lowest level. Click. So here are examples of accurate transformation. It could be, you know, Steve would help me in the Chinese versions. Right. But so a good example is Sarmad always talked to us about the different ways to write Mohammed, and so. This is one of those challenges.
I can just quickly add, Mark, because of Chinese there, accurate transformation usually is very language dependent. So, for example, the Chinese example, Jin Ren Qing. So if you're in the word, the first letter, Jin in China, you would translate or transliterate as Jin. But in Korea, you would do that as Kim. So it's very... requiring accurate transformation is very language dependent.
Yeah. Next slide. There are players in this field that have been working on this problem that are listed here. And we actually have looked at their the way the... let me see. Yeah, so next slide, we'll talk about one of those. So one thing is from the United Nations is what is written on the slide that says the Romance script, also referred as the Latin script, has been adopted as a base for international use by the United Nations, and the group of experts strongly recommends the development of a single romanization, that is to say, transliteration system for each non-Roman script. So This is kind of the not the, I would say the standard, but the method that is being more agreed and adopted in the international scene for example addresses. So essentially, romanization or transliteration to Roman script, which is essentially Latin, or if you want, ASCII with maybe some decorations. So, next. one of the things that is important to understand is there are often many tools that do work, quote-unquote, better or well within two pairs of languages or scripts, but not in general case for any script to any script. So, so the problem there is that we, for worldwide, all languages, all scripts, problem space, then we'll be focusing a little bit more on the tools that enable any script to any script instead of just two pairs, because that's has some scaling properties, obviously. And this slide actually shows that in terms of Unicode, there is if you can't do full pivotal as described in the previous slide, then you have another some methods to fallback methods for handling additional pairs that are not implemented or not available. So, about the submission and display practices, started a survey to understand what registries and registrars are doing right now. So, for example, questions such as, oh, is the data collected from the registrant in his own local and language or script? How is the data maintained when there's more than one language or script? Is there any translation, transliteration, or any transformation of that data? What is the role of the registrant in the process? Is there any enhancements of tools that are used in practice? For example, does the APP as extension, are APP extensions being used? What do they do with the current OIS services? How is the contact display? So this is a survey that has been targeted for both registrars and registries. And we are the survey has been done, piloted with a few registries and registrars, and we're currently trying to reach as many as possible registry and registrars. And if you're one of those parties here, please contact us, and we'll be happy to send you the URL for completing the survey. We hope to get more as much data as we can, and. Right. So, the third part of the study is evaluation of transformation tools. As I said before, we limit the evaluation to the tools that have a breadth of languages and not the ones that are limited to a single pair language pair. We look at the number of languages and scripts that are covered, standards used for the transformations, accuracy of representative language pairs, licensing information that open source, proprietary, or service in the cloud or something, and reversibility. So the way we just roughly started this part. The way we're doing right now is to have test cases in the main scripts, Arabic, Chinese, Devanagari, and a few others. And we actually input those test cases into each tool and then look at the output and see what's the accuracy of the output and if we can, revert back. So this are possible list candidates of testing, and we started with a few of them, so that's what we're currently doing in terms of testing the tools. And that's it.
Thank you, Mark. Any quick questions for Mark's presentation? Okay, so maybe I'll now like to open up to general discussions. Yeah. Any questions or comments? Margie?
I have a question for Mark. Are you also examining in the tools that you listed the UPU database?
No, in terms of, so we essentially try to have a, you know, a common test case that try to get a good scope, but we're not using a specific database. It's more like a set of words and that should appear in addresses and stuff like that.
Okay, thank you.
Rudy?
Yes, Rudy Vansnick for the transcript. when you are evaluating these tools, do you think about giving some indication about the value of what it allows to do, each tool, the limits, the advantages, or just mentioning the products itself?
State it again.
For instance, when you say it, the Google Translate API, mm-hmm. are you giving to give any indication what the value of it is, in the sense, is it trustful? Is it something we can count on, or is it just...
Okay. Mark speaking. So right now we're not at this phase. We're essentially more in terms of trying to see what they can do. I guess obviously after, then we'll have more a summary, and we will be more in position to tell, you know, more about these kinds of considerations. But that's not that what we're currently doing. We're really trying to, you know, test them, you know, to see with real data and same data for everybody to get a table of, you know, what they look like. Because as you could imagine, you know, language processing is not simple, and I think that those test cases, even if they are small, may show us a lot of good information for your work after, to see if this is really of any possible use or not, and what's the compromises and constraints and stuff. So we haven't done this yet, but we're currently focusing on really testing the tools.
Yeah, just to quickly add to that, it seems the study will provide data for the PDP working group to make decisions, right? So the policy has to make a determination based on the data whether the accuracy levels are acceptable. But the study will provide those. So
facts.
It provides facts, and yeah. for the policymaker, the working group to make decisions. Yeah. Is that Peter?
I was going to add that. That Mark is speaking. That we do not. We're tool neutral. We don't. We're not trying to say one or the other. We're just, you know, really back to facts, which is, you know, same test data in, output, compare. So you'll have to deal with the results.
Peter Durbach for the transcript. Can you go back just a couple of slides to the one that had the example of Mohammed and a question just on terminology. We note your use of transformation, which is actually quite nice in that it includes both translation and transliteration. But when we're talking about an accurate transformation, really there are two separate actions that are taking place, because first you need to identify the language. For example, there's a Chinese language name, which could be in Han script, but there could also be a name in Han script that is Korean name or a Japanese name. So first there's an identification of the input by language, and then a conversion of the script that has been recognized into a transformation. And so I just wanted to to ask you your thoughts on that, because when I saw your earlier report, I thought that the reference to transformation is actually quite helpful. But when we look at the specific examples, actually there's first an indication of what language it's in, and then a conversion of that script if you want to have an accurate transformation.
I was reminded we are out of time here, and the next session is about to start soon. So if possible, let's take this question offline.
Yeah. Sure. Thanks.
Okay, so thank you, and sorry we have to cut short. All the various related efforts groups are represented here, so if you want to chat afterwards, we can be outside. Thank you, and thank you.